It's my pleasure this morning to introduce to you one of the major Jewish thinkers of our time, Dr. Tamar Ross, who has taught in the Department of Jewish Philosophy at Bar-Ilan University and still teaches in Midrash Lindbaum in Yerushalayim. Dr. Ross is a world-renowned expert on the work of Rav Avraham Yitzchak Kook. She's most widely known currently for her seminal work in the area of women in Judaism and her 2004 publication, Expanding the Palace Torah, Orthodoxy, and Feminism. In our session following this one, we'll have a chance to go more in depth on the issues that are raised by that book. But this session is a continuation of a series that I began last year called Faith, in which we sit down one-on-one with significant Jewish figures and discuss with them their career, their influences, their spiritual development, their intellectual proclivities, and whatever else comes up. Dr. Ross, along with her husband Yaakov, who is also Professor Emeritus of Philosophy, have 7 children. They live in Yerushalayim. Won't you please welcome Dr. Tamar Ross. Dr. Ross, I wanted to start this morning by asking if you could please describe your upbringing in terms of religion. Your parents, how did they feel about Yadut? What was your household situation?
I was brought up in a rabbinic family. My father and his brothers were all rabbis. My parents were born in Europe, but they came to the States as young children. The bond that they had between them when they married was a love of Hebrew culture, and they decided before they married that they were going to raise their children Ivrit b'Ivrit at a time where that wasn't known at all. Religion, I think, was the center of the house. It was defined broadly as Jewish identity altogether. All the books in the house, and there were about 10,000 volumes, the language of conversation, the topics that were conversed about, the art that was hung on the walls, the Hebrew dates of the week, they were all part of my upbringing. When I learned to read English, which was later, of course, when I learned to read Hebrew, I noticed afterwards that when I skimmed through pages, the first thing that I was looking for and that jumped up in the page was capital J, because that was my prime feeling of identity, was Jewish, and I was looking always in any book for mention of Jewish. The type of religiosity, partly a deep veneration for Eastern European type of Yiddishkeit, that came from my father. Whereas my mother was brought up in a school that no longer exists in New York City. She went to public school, and she went in the afternoons to something called Bet HaSefer HaLeumi. I don't know if anybody heard of it. It catered, that was before Bet Yaakov had been established in the States, and certainly not any modern Orthodox Jewish day schools. It catered really for children from religious families, but all the teachers there were maskilim. And so my mother knew Hebrew well, and she had a heavy dose of Haskalah and general Hebrew literature knowledge, and that permeated into the house as well.
And as a child, do you remember, I don't know if you remember now, like how you felt about God, about faith, about tefillah? Did you have a feeling of faith? If so, did that emerge from your parents or other sources?
Hashem was there from birth. His presence was a natural and taken for granted thing, as was Torah and Halakha. That was just assumed. That's the way of doing things. That was the frame of reference. My first childhood memories, when I woke up in the morning, my father was there at my bed. First thing was Eze Yom Hayom, Mahaparsha, and sometimes he would try and kid me, and I slept for 2 days, he would say, and it's not Yom Sheni, it's Yom Rishon. God was my conscience. God was my company. I always felt that I had someone or something with me. Halakha presented firm standards. Another very firm memory in my formative for me was when I was a kid of about 5 or 6 at the Seder table. We were going through the Haggadah, and there was a bottle of soda in the middle of the table, and I wanted it. And my parents said, no, not now. And I grabbed it, and the lights on the table, which were still with flames, fell. And the thing that was imprinted in my memory, my parents could have said, you know, pikuach nefesh, da-da, but they didn't. And apparently they felt that something was going to be burned, but the table wasn't in danger. And the flames fell, and there was a hole in my mother's cherished dining table. And every year after that, I mean, it wasn't on purpose, but I was reminded of that when we sat at the Seder table. My mother's favorite tablecloth had a patch on it. And so the idea of taking halachot very, very seriously was implanted from childhood, not taking the easy way out. But like all children, I certainly at some stage had a feeling of the gap between the reality of God and his abstraction, and a feeling of not being quite so sure what was what. And I can tell you already, also with my children in the family, we have a book that's called Sefer HaChochmot, where children from the age between 2 and 4 always say Chochmot that they never repeat again. And we used to write them down. And every one of my children, as I did myself, went through a stage of trying to philosophize in childlike terms about God. For example, I have one child who would ask, does God have hands? I say, no. Doesn't have feet? No. And he doesn't wear a kippah? And he doesn't go to Bet Knesset? And I also went through that phase, and I remember sometimes at night at a certain age, when I was saying the Shema, I would also, either in my heart or even in words, ask God, let's make a bargain between us, just to make sure you're around. Do me a favor, and when I wake up in the morning, fly a red string in the sky or something, just so I'll know that I'm really in touch and you're there. So that was a first sense of a feeling of not quite sure, or I need something firmer. But being Jewish altogether meant going against the grain and fighting against sometimes common sense or surrounding concepts. And issues became much stronger and more articulate as a teenager, where first of all, one of my religious issues was rebelling against a type of middle class bourgeois, young Israel type of, young Israel today is something else. Young Israel today represents something more right wing and strict in the modern Orthodox world, or that's the image they try to present. But in my time in Detroit, that type of middle class Orthodox religiosity was something that I felt I had to rebel against, and I was looking for a type of religious idealism that sought consistent halachic standards and veered towards idealization and romanticization of the yeshiva world. And the disparity between the type of religiosity I saw around me in the American modern Orthodox scene was a new kind of cognitive dissonance that I experienced.
I mean, when people see you, I've had this experience where people have come to me and they've said something like, I mean, that's the woman who wrote that book? You know, she wears a tichel, and I don't get it, right? So clearly, there's a complex combination going on here, because you've mentioned, both today and when I've met you previously, about the sort of heavy influence of sort of Eastern European background. And when we were sitting at my Shabbat table this Shabbat, and Dr. Ross was, you know, fully in tune with certain, you know, Hasidic and Nigunim. So obviously there's an odd combination that's occurred here. And what I wanted to ask you was, were some of the issues that came to exercise you as an adult, in terms of halakha specifically, already percolating as a teenager, or would you say that those really only came later?
To a certain extent, as a teenager, I grew up in an atmosphere where, again, there was religious seriousness, taking halakha very seriously. On the other hand, I grew up in a very open intellectual atmosphere. Part of this was a decision on my parents' part, even though my father established the first day school in Detroit, and it was obviously a religious day school. He decided not to send me there because he abhorred the idea that I would learn Torah in translation. And at that time, they didn't have religious Israeli shlichim. And so the way Torah was studied in that school was Bereshit bara, and the Lord created, and going by rote in Tilgum. And to him, that was totally abhorrent. And so he sent me to public school. My parents both decided I should go to public school, and they would educate me privately, religiously. And every day, my father, although he was a very busy askan tziburi, how do you translate?
Public servant.
Yeah.
You know.
He would take off. His study doors would be closed, and my mother knew he was not going to answer the telephone. And he taught me privately, and the subjects he didn't want to teach me, they got private teachers to teach me, and that was a prime value in my upbringing. But the clash sometimes that was obvious between the atmosphere in public school, the open intellectual atmosphere, certainly allowed me to raise questions. And in the house, even though my parents were not professional theologians or anything like that, but there was an underlying assumption that every question had its place, and there was an optimism that something could be developed to overcome and resolve difficulties. And so for me, it was quite natural to speak about anything with no holds barred, and not to try and smooth over difficulties or to engage in apologetics. And that is what carried on into adulthood. And certainly when I married Yaakov, this was something that we had in common. He also came from that kind of complicated background. On the one hand, going to Yeshivat Panovich, which was Haredi. On the other hand, going to Cambridge. And being able to honestly face what each system said and to address these questions in a very open-eyed, cleared manner, this was something that formed our bonds in marriage as well.
Do you remember any specific examples of something that engaged you at that time that you would say?
Well, certainly things got more intensified when I started my studies at Hebrew University. And at Hebrew University, although I knew before there were questions of Torah or Mada, at Hebrew University I was exposed in a very deep way to the scientific study of Judaism. And so I began to understand the complications of historicism, the complications of that are raised by comparative religions, the role of sociology in the development of religion, textual analysis, linguistics, all these things impacted, first of all, on the question of biblical criticism. And this was an issue that for years was percolating, and I was all the time trying to develop some sort of systematic response. Another issue which is subsidiary to that is the development of halakha. To what extent is halakha objective, subjective, that sort of thing.
Right. Well, let's just take a step back. How old were you when you made Aliyah?
I first came when I was 16 years old. I finished high school a bit early. And I came to study for a year in Israel At that time, there were none of the midrashot that exist today for women's higher education, not even the michlala. It's regarded as prehistoric times. And I had either two options. One was to go to a teacher's training seminar at Bet Yaakov that did exist, or to go to a seminar which doesn't exist anymore for training teachers and madrichim in youth aliyah villages. This was the time that they were getting in Israel olim chadashim. First of all, there were still people, children, a few years earlier that had been shipped over from what was left of the Holocaust. And then afterwards there were, it was Moroccan Aliyah, Algerian Aliyah, and so forth. And these villages were created for children who came without their parents. In the end, I decided to go to that seminar, even though I wasn't particularly committed to being a youth Aliyah, madricha, or teacher. But they had a very good program of Limudei Kodesh, and I enjoyed the year very much. And at the end of that year, I wrote my parents that I would like to stay. And this was just the trigger that my parents were waiting for. I think my whole upbringing was based on the idea that I was in America just by chance, and my natural home was in Israel, and my parents were certainly responsible for that feeling. And they decided that they would make Aliyah as well. My father was offered a very interesting position, which he took as the general secretary of the chief rabbinate. And I've been living in Israel ever since.
And do you, I mean, speculation is hard to make, of course, but do you feel that your intellectual development is a product of having gone to Israel? Do you think it would have been a different path?
Absolutely.
Right? So do you see a difference in Jewish studies, let's say, the scholarship in Israel as opposed to Chutz La'aretz in terms of, you know, focus or interest or quality?
Yes.
Well, how would you characterize the differences?
First of all, in terms of quality, there are more Talmidei Chachamim for every square meter in Yerushalayim than you can find across North America. And there's tremendous, I mean, Jerusalem is just a steaming pot of issues all the time. I mean, I live there, and every day there are new ideas going bang, 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 and you just can't keep up with it all. But besides that, I feel that living in Israel, it makes these issues far more real, far more profound, forcing people to address them more honestly. In North America and in general in the diaspora, religious Jews can sort of sustain themselves by creating some sort of cultural bubble in which they are in and cordon off certain areas which they regard as dangerous or not comfortable and leave that for the non-Orthodox or for the non-Jews. In Israel, that's not so. Questions such as certainly the scientific study of Judaism, also how do we relate to the arts, how do we relate to all kinds of live issues become much more pressing and force people to address them more honestly, more profoundly, and to address them. And so, yes.
Mm-hmm. I know that one of your early teachers was Nechama Leibowitz. There's actually a new biography that came out about Nechama now in Hebrew, in which Dr. Ross talks about some of her memories of Nechama Leibowitz. What was she like as a teacher, and what kind of role would you say she played in your development Jewishly?
Nechama Leibowitz was a very warm, lively, opinionated woman. At the time, I don't think, you know, people expect me to say Nechama Leibowitz was the figure that influenced me from a woman's point of view. I don't think so. At the time, perhaps unconsciously, I was proud of the fact that there was a woman who was so knowledgeable, and she was the one woman teaching Limudei Kodesh in Seminar Beit Vegan where I studied. But that wasn't what impressed me. She was part of a whole crowd of teachers, a whole circle, who again represented a type of religiosity which was different than what I knew in the States. On the one hand, she was certainly a Yirat Shamayim in a very simple, straightforward way. When she spoke to Rabbanim, and even when she met my father, it struck me as strange. She would address them in the third person. You know, that's the way you do it in Hebrew, the Haredi circles. On the other hand, she was very much no-nonsense religiosity. The idea that she couldn't teach because she was a woman, that was, you know, give me a break. You know, that's not an issue at all. She was also very connected with the Kibbutz Adati movement and all that ideology, which was somewhat left-wing to the orthodoxy that I knew in the States. She, as a teacher, was very gifted in the sense that she knew how to draw out students. Her lessons were never passive. She always asked thought-provoking questions, and she made sure that everybody answered these questions. There was no such thing as sitting back in her class and just passively listening. And she was an inspiration in her dedication to her teaching. I don't know if all of you know about the project that she generated, which is more or less like a one-man open university. She started out her teaching. She developed the notion of gilyonot, that is, source sheets in which she presented classical medieval philosophers debating regarding certain issues, generally moral issues, in reading the parsha, and then asking thought-provoking questions. And these sheets were handed out to whoever was interested, and they, by mail, returned to her answers, and she would mark them. And these gilyonot became very popular, not only among official students and in religious institutions, but even secular kibbutzim were very taken with the way she taught. And so she really generated an enormous amount of Torah, and one-handedly, with no help of other people, every day she would, every week she would correct these thousands of gilyonot, and this she did for years and years. So she had a tremendous amount of students passing under her hands.
I'm just trying to piece together the personal and the professional. So you went to Hebrew U, you did a BA there.
Yeah.
And then did you go further, or did that stop? And when did you marry Yaakov?
Okay. I married Yaakov sort of towards the end of my BA, and I had 1 foot in the MA for a year. Then we went abroad. Yaakov already had a sabbatical coming to him from, he was teaching Bar-Ilan University at the time. And over the years, I had 7 kids, and I was hardly involved in so I had the beginning of an MA, but that was it. And when we came back to Israel, we had a stint in the States and then in England. We came back to Israel 4.5 years later, and I was busy raising the kids, and finished my MA quite slowly, and I got into academia very late in life. I finished my doctorate only in 1987. And
so you were well into your 50s at that point when you finished your PhD.
I had a dream of going into academia. All this I sort of bumbled into by chance.
How did that happen?
Well, first of all, how I started. I started first in Midrash at Lindenbaum. And even that was by chance. I mean, there was a certain period, well, this is a side story, but when I had these kids, when we were in England, I had an au pair, an Israeli girl who would come in. And when we came back to Israel, that was just the time after the Six-Day War, and we built our dream house in Gibat HaMiftar. People could build private houses. I thought, wow, I have a big house now. I can have an au pair in Israel. And but the concept wasn't known. So I looked in the paper and I saw there was an ad of the Ministry of Social Welfare looking for foster families for what they called Na'arot b'Mitzuka, women, young women in distress. So I called up and I asked, could we do this arrangement? And the social worker said, just fine. And then she brought along the young woman in question, and I had one look at her. I said, no way, Jose, that I'm not going to give her my kids. And I sort of told the social worker, you know, she looked like she came off the streets and was dressed very inappropriately and so forth. And, you know, it was different human material. And the social worker planted a guilt trip on me, and she said, if I don't take this girl, she's going to be on the streets, and she doesn't have a family. Have to take her in at least for Shabbat and so forth. That one girl became two girls, became three girls, and I became a social worker. And so instead of having somebody to help me with the seven kids, I had another three on my hands. And I sort of was toying with the idea of going professionally into social work. And then I met Rabbi Brappender's wife, whom I knew casually in a butcher shop. And she told me, hey, my husband is starting an institution for teaching young women Limudei Torah Shebaal Peh. Maybe you'd like to give a shiur there. He needs somebody in Machshava. So I said, okay, and that's how it developed. And academia, I wrote a few articles, and Stam Lishma, you know, I published them in the scholarly journal. And as a result of one of them, I got a job offer. And that's how it sort of developed.
This is from Bar-Ilan, you got a job offer?
Yeah, but I even told them that, I mean, today you wouldn't think of such things, job. They're so far between, or I should have copped it. But I said, no, they wanted me to teach medieval Kabbalah. I said, no, I didn't feel quite comfortable in that. And I waited, and I got another offer in Be'er Sheva. It took a long time. But anyway, I got into academia. And through no... and it's sort of funny when you talk about me as some sort of great thinker. I don't conceive of myself. You know, these things, I sort of, chances opened up and I write articles now because people ask me to. It's not as if I have some sort of vision that I'm trying to sell and none of that.
And where did the interest in Rav Kook develop? I know that... You know, your book obviously draws from a phrase from Rav Kook's writing, and you've devoted, if you look through the career, there's a good deal of scholarly writing that's devoted to Rav Kook. When did you first become interested in his work?
Yeah, that started very early, and he was really a formative influence and is to this day. And really, I'd like, if I don't know how much time we have, to convey some of the excitement that Rav Kook presented for me. How I started with him? Well, first of all, in my father's library, my father had everything. And he collected writings of Rav Kook before they were part of a nice sidra of Kol Kitvei Rav Kook. And he told me later, I never knew people were going to make of him such a big deal. You know, there were a few things published, and then it was even before Medinat Yisrael, and he collected them. And I had a look at them. I started becoming interested as a student. And at the same time, as a student, again, you know, I had this idealization of the yeshiva world, but it was not something I could come close to. Most of the yeshivot in Israel were... I had grown up in Bnei Akiva. That's another story, which maybe you'll remind me, and I'll tell you something about that. My father sort of organized my social life when he realized in public school that I might be getting into trouble and going off the way he figured for me.
We'll remind you of that. Yeah.
Okay. He imported a shaliach to the States so that his Tamar could have a social circle. You know, that's controlling things, you know, on the side. But anyway, I came to Israel, met on the enthusiastic wave of Bnei Akiva, and I felt, you know, the boys in Hebron and Panevish, they were just, actually not, Panevish was not suits and hats then, it was still khaki and a kova casket, but they were not approachable, whereas the students of Merkaz was a tiny yeshiva, really tiny, just a few students on Rehov Rav Kook, not where they are today. But these were approachable, these young men. They wore sandalim tanachiyot, they had open shirts, and there was an organization that was created between some religious students and some boys from Merkaz Rav to go to Yishuvei Olim on Shabbatot and try and foster the religious life in the Yishuvim. And so I got to know some of them personally and even more deeply than personally. And we used to learn together K'tayim of Rav Kook. And these young men embodied for me some of the qualities which afterwards I attributed to Rav Kook himself, a certain sweetness, a certain wish to be involved in what was going on in general society. And his writings, first of all, what was attractive about them on a very surface level was just that it was beautiful writings. Even if he writes very esoterically, but he writes personal diaries, which is also a genre which you hardly find among traditional rabbis, and writes with extreme candor about himself. But more than his personality, which was saintly, and you felt, even if you didn't understand the words, that there was not only beauty here, but a very intense spiritual life, which sort of expanded your notions of what the human soul could do. But when I got into the writings, I found an approach which I found nowhere else. I won't say that Rav Kook is entirely devoid of apologetics. There is some of that. But his approach to some of the problems that some of the questions that I was having in confronting the scientific study of Judaism and in confronting the notion of development of halakha, I found in him an approach which was very exciting. It was anti-establishment. It had breath to it. It was original. It was audacious. And it captivated me. And I think, I was sort of toying in my mind whether to do this, but I think I will. I want to sort of summarize for you maybe one or two or three passages that whatever comes to my mind, sort of that you get the flavor of what's unique about Rav Kook. I think I'll start, if we're talking about, you know, one of the common favorite topics in modern Orthodoxy, Torah Umada, Torah and science. How do you put them together? And the general approach of modern Orthodoxy, certainly in the States and Canada, is these are two disciplines that are playing on the same ballpark, and they're competing with each other, and either one is right or one is wrong, or we have to synthesize between them so that they're both saying the same thing, but that's the conception. Rav Kook offered me something else. Okay, I'll start out. Well, all right, let me start out with one thing. First of all, one of his passages, he has a concept of three layers. Everybody is born with what he calls Ikar HaEmunah, a basic feeling of faith. This basic feeling, which is not only, he believes, common to humanity, but even to the created world at large, which animates creation, is a pre-verbal urge. It doesn't have any shape to it. All you can say about it, I can mimic it, is it's an urge to go upwards. It's an urge for perfection. It's an urge for being more. The object of that urge is something not preverbal but beyond words. When I teach about this, I call it you don't even call it God. It's beyond God. Between the Ikar HaEmunah and that object, which is called HaEmet HaElyonah in his vocabulary, there is a middle ground, which is what he calls HaEmunah HaMuchachat or HaEmunah HaMetsuyeret. Necessary belief or conceptualized beliefs. And in this middle area, this is the area of all the isms that we create in civilization. This is an attempt to give structure to the basic preverbal Ikar HaEmunah and to allow it to grow. Sometimes he calls Ikar HaEmunah, one passage, images like a little sapling. We're born with a little sapling, and in order to allow that sapling to grow, we need a kind of stick or prop so that it can lean on it and develop. That stick or prop are all the isms that we create. They can be Buddhism, Judaism, Christianity, but they can also be Marxism and communism and even atheism. All these isms that we create are really attempts to give shape to to that preverbal urge to go forward. And then he says, sometimes it happens, using the image of the sapling, that this little plant, it grows and grows, and it outgrows the stick. So what do you have to, or it outgrows the base of the plant. So then what do you have to do? You have to remove that stick and put in a new stick, or plant in richer soil and broader soil. This is what he regards as our religious ideas. Our religious ideas are not static, eternal truths. They are only attempts to formulate that truth. And in that sense, he makes a very radical statement. Atheism and emunah are really on the same status. Both of them are not pictures of the, or do not grasp, do not correspond, do not replicate perfectly that ultimate reality. But how do we evaluate then which is better, faith or atheism, or between the different faiths? Whatever ism allows that more, he calls it a moral urge, but not morality in the usual everyday sense, what allows that urge to grow, what instills in it optimism and faith in the future and zest for life and so forth. And so never do our religious truths remain static. They are always open to new developments. Now, we'll leave that passage, and I want to give you another passage. In this passage, he talks about three developments in modern science. And he starts out that passage saying, very often people think that when you have two ideas or a cluster of ideas that are associated together, if one element in that cluster changes, then everything changes. And what he's talking about really is, by association, religion for a long time has been associated with certain scientific models of reality. And once we change those models, then we feel, oi vavoy, our religion has fallen. And he brings three examples to show that is not the case, but rather a certain adjustment has to be made. And the examples are very interesting. The first example is sociology or anthropology. In sociology or anthropology, in previous generations, certainly in the 19th century, we used to think that every society is an island unto itself. Every nation has its own particular spirit, has its own particular language, its own particular culture, its own customs, and they all express the unique spirit of that nation or society. And he said, we Jews were the worst of all in this particular fallacy because of anti-Semitism or because we wanted to consciously develop our uniqueness. And so we thought there's a pure kind of Judaism. There's something that is hermetically sealed against outside influences. But today, and he wrote this nearly 100 years ago, today it's even more pronounced. It's a rather prescient article. Today, we realize that whatever, if somebody sneezes in Honolulu, there are repercussions in Timbuktu. That everything, all of society, certainly in an area, in an era of globalization, all societies are interrelated and they interact upon each other. That's one movement. A second movement is in the area of cosmology. Once we used to think, and this was an assumption in religious views, that the earth is the center of the universe. Whereas today we realize that the sun doesn't revolve around the earth, but the other way around. And altogether we are a little speck in a whole stream of galaxies, and everything interacts on everything else. It's all vast and yet interconnected. The third example is the most interesting, and that is in evolution, in biology. Once we used to think that man was a unique creature, created unto himself. And now, Darwin teaches us that we are related to the monkeys, and we are interested in what happens in plant life, and there are certain ecological connections here and there and everywhere. And he says the difficulty for religious believers, you might think that it is, how do we resolve Darwinism or the theory of evolution with what's written in the Torah? He said, baloney, that's not the problem. Even common people know that when we are dealing with very profound matters such as creation, they're used to the idea, you can fob them off with the notion is, with everything is mashal v'rem, as everything is a parable, because you can't talk about these profound things directly. So you can resolve the question, the clash between the theory of evolution and the story of the creation of man in Torah through allegory, through symbolization. That's not the problem. What's the real problem? The real problem is, we were used to a certain, in the religious context, to a certain image of what human beings are. We are unique. And now we see that we are interconnected with all sorts of lower forms of being. But, Rav Kook, at the end of this whole, these three different sets, hints to us that these parallel movements, which happened without any prior synchronization. I mean, the cosmologists didn't talk to the anthropologists, and the anthropologists didn't talk to the biologists. But what is motivating all of them is an unconscious urge to develop a new religious paradigm. What is really motivating all of them is a dissatisfaction. I mean, they don't realize it, but a dissatisfaction with the ordinary conception of monotheism, which sees God as over and above and transcendent to reality, and we are down here with no connection to that perfection. And in many passages, Rav Kook compares the notion of monotheism to more pantheistic ideas of God, and says monotheism, although it's a necessary step that we have to take in our personal biographies, in our education, and even in civilization at large, that is not the true conception of God. The idea that God stands over and above the universe, and he is there in his solitary perfection, and we are down below, so that anything we do will never even come close to his perfection, is a very depressing thought. It sometimes causes human beings to feel jealousy of God. That's a very strange conception. I mean, who are we jealous of? We're usually jealous of people that are close to us. We're not jealous of Rothschild. It's a window into Rav Kook's soul that he felt so close to God to be able to say he's jealous of him. But he believes that humanity now, we are striving for a new model of reality which will justify the notion that not only are we connected to lower forms of reality, but there's also a continuum between us and the higher worlds, i.e. God. So that this model of reality that plays out in science is simply a preamble to a new conception of spirituality in the religious mode.
Well, that's amazing, actually. So I can see exactly where that would be extremely engaging, and that obviously has a dominant effect on the way you develop intellectually and spiritually. I'm thinking about a segue into the other sort of side of your work, which had to do with development of halakha, and in the last, 10, 15 years, reaches an apex in terms of your writing specifically on orthodoxy and feminism. And I just want to quote the opening of Dr. Ross's book, Expanding the Palace of Torah. You write, I never used to think of myself as a feminist. And you clarify that your reservations have to do with perhaps the preoccupation with gender that feminism usually implies. And also feminism's alienation sometimes from the normative mainstream, especially given that, as you emphasize now, you were born and raised and continue to identify with Orthodox Judaism. So given all that, it's maybe a bit ironic that you have found yourself in the last number of years as one of the central flashpoints for a very raw and sometimes very contentious debate about the place of feminism within traditional Judaism. And you narrate something I'd like you to talk about now, what seems to have been a very telling incident in retrospect, which took place in 1997. You were invited to speak at Yeshiva University's Orthodox Forum. The Orthodox Forum is a kind of closed meeting that takes place every spring at YU of certain modern Orthodox rabbis and teachers. It's by invitation only. It's not like everybody can crash the party. And the topic that year was on the general theme of human and societal influence on halakha. How does halakha get influenced? And you were asked to deliver a paper focusing in on so-called, quote-unquote, women's issues as a test case. And you wrote of that experience the following, quote, "It soon became obvious that members of the American modern Orthodox establishment," note, modern Orthodox establishment, we're not talking about Haredim, "were not prepared to deal critically with the issues at hand. After I presented an oral summary of the paper, the atmosphere was heavy and oppressive. The rabbis' faces were somber, and everyone was determined to be politically correct, that is, in terms of the establishment. Nearly everyone who asked for the floor began with a variant of, 'I am very disturbed by,' and so on." So I want to ask you two questions in retrospect. Number one, the obvious question is, what do you think in specific was so troubling to the members of the Orthodox Forum about your position? And number two, do you think looking back on it retrospectively, I don't mean this pejoratively, that maybe you were a bit naive regarding how your work on feminism might be received within mainstream Orthodoxy? But let's begin with the first. What do you think was so troubling?
The implications of the feminist critique, they have many repercussions. Some of them, I think, even though they are revolutionary, the forum might have been able to handle, such as feminism gives women their own voice, feminist accomplishments threaten the exclusivity of the male preserve of the religious establishment. Perhaps there's also a measure of threatening the authority of the religious establishment by acquiescing to the influence of women that comes from the grassroots rather than initiated from above. Yet I think if I had restricted myself simply to these issues, things would have gone more peacefully. But I also chose to show, and that's something I don't think I want to go into too deeply here because we'll talk about it in the next session, how feminism really has a very profound theological challenge to make to the current understanding of Torah min haShamayim as it is propagated in modern Orthodoxy. The idea of a divine Torah from heaven that was dictated word for word to Moshe Rabbeinu at Sinai. Because of highlighting a male bias or a male perspective that is all-pervasive in the Torah. I think that modern Orthodox theology is very primitive. And this was, so to speak, catching the forum with their pants down. I remember in 1966 there was a survey in commentary interviewing representatives of Orthodoxy, Conservative Reform, and perhaps Reconstructionists, how they understood the notion of divine revelation. And I remember reading the Orthodox response and feeling embarrassed. You know, I didn't feel that these were my spokesmen. And I feel that deep down, the wish to avoid developing a response to that question is what really provoked the storm at the forum. And as I told Elliot over the trip to here, I brought a book which I am going to recommend to all of you, which the author asked me to read, and even though he misrepresents my position there, I'm already telling you, He didn't understand it, but he told me he'd really like me to review this book, and even if I bash it, I should at least tell everybody that every Orthodox person, it's a must-read for them. So I'm going to do that, because I really think it is true. And the book is called The Tenacity of Unreasonable Belief, written by Saul Schimmel, a person who now lives more or less an Orthodox way of life, orthoprax, but has had his faith shattered over this issue. The cover of the book, I think, is very successful. The cover is of an ostrich burying its head in the sand. And that's enough said.
Did you expect the antagonism you received, or were you surprised by that?
I didn't think that they would take it lightly, but yes, I am in Israel, and that's the difference, I think, between Israel and Orthodoxy in the States. At least the circles I move in Israel, both in Midrashet Lindenbaum and in the university and in the community of my Bet Knesset and other Batei Knesset of modern Orthodoxy in Yerushalayim, it's much easier to talk honestly and openly. And I really didn't expect such a unwillingness to address these issues. No. I remember David Schatz mumbling next to me, "She really doesn't understand how radical she sounds."
Uh-huh. Yeah. Yeah. And within your own family, your children, you know, I know from talking to you that there's a disparity in the hashkafot of your children, but how have they responded to your work?
My children, as I told you, I don't like to talk shop with my children. They imbibe what they imbibe over the years. I talk shop with my husband. But when Elliot sent me this question, I made sort of a telephone survey. I remember when I gave the book to my children, so my eldest son, who is just straight from without any philosophizing, he said, "Ima, well, I'll wait until the movie comes out." And then I have another son who lives in Bnei Brak and is extremely Haredi, and this book is totally without beyond his ken. I mean, the whole issue of feminism, he lives and his wife live in a world in which there's total shleimut in the old way, and they don't have problems, and they wouldn't. This is not the kind of book they would have in their library, and they wouldn't even begin to understand it. Among the other children, several of them, said this wasn't a revelation for us, this book. They thought it was a good book. It sharpened for them things, but they had imbibed this with their mothers and mother's milk and their father's whatever. And other children, one of them, she said, I appreciate the problems you raise. For me, I don't need the theologically sophisticated answers. I just live in the normal religious images and don't think about them too much, and sort of think practically how to resolve any problems on the pragmatic level.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to ask you something that came up last year. We had actually, Menachem Kellner came here for in last February, and he stayed with us, and he told me, and then I looked it up, he wrote in his book, Maimonides' Confrontation with Mysticism, the following, and I thought it was quite fascinating and something that resonated me in your work as well, so I'm wondering if you think the idea is correct. Professor Kellner wrote, "Had the first human being to discover the truth about God been, say, a Navajo Indian, and had that Navajo philosopher possessed the courage and effectiveness of Abraham, then the Navajos would be the chosen people. And the Torah would have been composed in Navajo language, and its narratives would reflect Navajo history and the nature of Navajo society at the time of the giving of the Torah to them." And I think we can all appreciate what the implications of this statement are. Do you think this idea is correct? And do you think it has any cross-application to the feminist critique?
Short answer, yes. Of course it had cross applications to the feminist critique. And here I have to plug for Elliot's daughter. At the Shabbat table, this is a girl of 9, going on 10, who's so precocious it's frightening. And she was talking about the parsha, and I don't know how it entered. It wasn't even her main topic. Suddenly she said, how is it nobody's talking about Avraham Avinu's mother? Why isn't she mentioned? And Elliot said, she must have had vibes who you are. I don't know why. She's never presented this before. But here, a little 9-year-old girl already feels that there's something about the way the Torah is narrated which leaves out a woman's point of view, the implication being that the Torah is written from a male perspective. And had, at the time that it was written or edited or whatever, women involved, that the narration would be a different narration from a woman's perspective.
We're going to talk about this more extensively in the next session, but I just want to, you know, kick it off. As I said before, if you read Expanding the Palace of Torah, and I would really recommend for every person in this room to read it and read it carefully. I've read it twice now, and it took two readings at least to really pin down certain things. But it's one of the real misnomers and misreputations about this book is that this is a book just about feminism. It is actually, I consider, and I've asked Dr. Ross about this, I consider feminism to be the layer by which she really begins to explore gut primary issues of Jewish theology, specifically Torah Min HaShamayim. And that's really the elephant in the room of orthodoxy, is how do people feel about the Torah, where does it come from, who wrote it, and specifically, for those of us who believe that God wrote the Torah, the problem is that we find ourselves with less maneuverability than, say, our conservative Reform brothers and sisters. Because if there's a passage in there that I find unpleasant or even offensive, and there are several that are enormously disturbing to me, I just throw out one, Amalekite genocide, for instance, child sacrifice. There's a whole list, and everybody has their own personal list. Students I teach, peers I have who are not Orthodox can simply say, well, these are unpleasant verses. They can place them in the cultural context of ancient patriarchy. They can say, well, what do I care that some ancient Mesopotamian guy wrote this? It doesn't matter to me. You know, it's just ancient sexism or ancient racism. But for an Orthodox person, ostensibly, that's a very difficult maneuver to make, right? Because we are associating the text with divine author. And so you have an acute tension. So, as I said, we're going to talk about this in depth with Dr. Ross and Rav Gilad and Dr. Finkelman and Rabbi Lau in the next session, but I'm wondering if you can start to discuss the concept that you develop later in the book called cumulativism and how you think this idea can help us with the problem that I've just explicated.
What I call cumulativism is I've given a name to an idea which I haven't invented. It's very central to the sources. Essentially reflects the very obvious idea that if we're talking about God giving an infinite and eternal message in his Torah, if he is giving it to finite minds, then of necessity, the revelation of that message must be a protracted process. God's message is timeless, but any particular generation can only view one slice of what the Torah ultimately means to convey. However, every slice is added to the previous slice. We always come to our understanding with the weight of a tradition that shapes that understanding, and thereby it forms a continuous pattern. I think that whole notion is encapsulated very nicely in a well-known story in Menachot, which talks about, I think, I'll tell the story, but I think most of you are familiar with it, of Moshe Rabbeinu when he went up on Mount Sinai, and he sees, he's about to receive the Torah, and he sees HaKadosh Baruch Hu is busy kosher ktarim la'otiyot. He's putting all sorts of jots and tittles on the letters. And he asked Kadosh Baruch Hu, what are you doing there? You don't have to do that for me. Give me the Torah. And the Kadosh Baruch Hu says, no, these jots and tittles are very important because several generations hence, there is going to be a Talmid Chacham who is going to be Doresh Tilei Tilim Shel Halachot. He's going to learn all sorts of halachic minutiae out of these jots and tittles. And Moshe Rabbeinu is very impressed. Do you know this story? Okay. So I don't have to repeat the rest? Okay. So Moshe Rabbeinu is impressed and he says, well, wow, show him to me. And so, as it were in a time machine, Kadosh Baruch Hu moves him up to the Bet Midrash of Rabbi Akiva, and Moshe Rabbeinu sits incognito in the back rows, and he hears the discussion going on in the Bet Midrash of Rabbi Akiva, supposedly about the Torah that he gave to Am Yisrael, and he feels terrible. He doesn't understand a word of what's going on. Until finally, somebody raises his hand and says to Rabbi Akiva, Rabbi Akiva, where did you get that notion from? And Rabbi Akiva says, Halacha la Moshe Mesinai. It's halacha from Moshe at Sinai. And the interesting ending is revealing because it reveals to us how Chazal viewed the Torah. They say Moshe Rabbeinu's reaction was, he was relieved. What does that mean, he was relieved? Because he already had a conception that his Torah was only a kernel. And the fact that it was being played out in ways that he couldn't even imagine or understand, but nevertheless related to that original Torah, that was the conception of Chazal.
So you're arguing that by definition, a priori, the Torah is on some level an open text.
That's right.
That
yeah.
keeps getting added to and added to and added to. I guess one of the major issues in religious debate is who gets to add to it, you know.
Okay, that's a whole new ball game.
Yeah.
But I just want to add that I think it's unfortunate. I can understand the reasons why this happened. One of them is sort of to delineate ourselves as against conservative and reform, who talk about change as the sort of flag, but we don't learn or emphasize these sort of sources. And the Torah is understood as something fixed, metaphysically ensconced and rigid, not affected by life. And this is not a traditional conception, or certainly not a dominant one.
Lastly, and we're gonna finish off this session and then take a break and then move to the next session specifically on feminism. You've been in Israel a long time. And you've seen a lot of change in religion in that time. And many people in Chutz La'aretz, in the diaspora, I've often found, have a little bit of a fantasy perception of Israel. But we like to talk about the Holy Land and, you know, a place where Torah is at its peak, and that's true. But one also senses a great deal of hostility towards religion and tensions within the religious community itself, tensions that we alluded to last night. How do you personally see the situation? And what do you think is necessary to improve it? And lastly, and speculation is an endeavor of a fool, so I'll call myself a fool, but I'm going to ask you to think how Rav Kook might react to the secular religious divide in Israel today, because as everyone is aware who's read some of Rav Kook's writing, he had a certain optimism, a certain theological affirmation of the role that secular Zionism would play in the redemptive process. And this is admittedly going back many decades. So how do you see the situation now? How do you think Rav Kook would see the situation now?
What's going on in Israel is very interesting and exciting. On the one hand, there's a generation that has grown up which is not like the generation of its fathers. That was the one that Rav Kook related to, who were people who rebelled against religion, but they had religion in their bones. They had the tradition in their bones. They knew what they were rebelling against. And there Rav Kook could even appreciate that there was, and even empathize, because he understood them as rebelling against a very narrow conception of religion, which was a necessary element of galut living, but which he felt had to be corrected in Eretz Yisrael. And so he saw the rebellion as part of the dialectic, which was going to lead to a higher, more comprehensive, more profound view of religion. A generation later, one observing the religious scene might have turned to despair, because this generation that he knew produced a group of Amei Haaretz, who felt much more comfortable with cosmopolitanism or with Western culture, and a certain shallowness in its cultural activity altogether, which even the secularists felt and criticized themselves for. But there's something happening now which might have produced or confirmed for Rav Kook his optimism, is that there is a very exciting now new interest on the part of secularists, not all, but some of the leading cultural lights, feeling that they've been deprived of their past and wanting to return to study the classic sources. In Hebrew, they call it Chazara le'aron ha'sfarim ha'yehudi. There's a wish to appropriate the classic bookshelves of traditional Judaism. And in fact, it's very interesting. Yediot Achronot, just a well-known publishing house in Israel, is producing the classics, the Mishnah, Talmud, Zohar, along with modern Misilat Yesharim, and this is being bought up by general people, and they feel they have to hold this in their library. And there are Batei Midrash that are coming up all over Israel, and even Batei Knesset, Chilonim, which sounds like an oxymoron, but trying to develop a new way of relating to these sources with fresh eyes. There is a certain collaboration with certain elements of the religious population who feel they even have something to learn when learning with people who are approaching these texts with fresh eyes that are unmediated by the accretion of generations. And there are all sorts of interesting now reshuffling of the denominational cards, so that the old notions of what is religious and not religious, what is religious and what is secular, is redefined. And I think we're in for several surprises of what is going to emerge in the spiritual life coming out of Israel.
Dr. Ross, thank you very much.